Welcome to The Art Box, recorded in our beautiful Mesquite, Nevada, and sponsored by the Virgin Valley Artists Association. Our association provides creative opportunities for all ages. Get creative with us at the Mesquite Fine Arts Center, 15 West Mesquite Boulevard, or find us online at mesquitefineartscenter.com or on Facebook, The Art Box.
Steve, hello, how are you today?
I'm just doing wonderful.
I read this fantastic book, Path of Light, by Morgan Shogren. It was fascinating, drew me in right away, and I said, can we interview her?
Yeah, and it's about land that we all love.
Exactly.
Out here, and a lot of people don't know about that land.
So welcome, Morgan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Do you want to tell us how the title of the book came to be? I thought that story was really good. And then tell us a little bit about what you did out in the desert.
Yeah, so the title, Path of Light, it came to me from, that's a hard one to dive into without some context with the book. I'm just going to go out right there and say it.
Okay. The
great-grandson of one of the explorers that is profiled in this book passed along a story from a Diné Navajo elder about choosing the path of light, which is basically taking the hardships that you've been given and staying focused on what needs to be done to choose the light and take positive steps for the future, not just for yourself as an individual, but also the community. And so that story sort of became a guiding light during a hard period of my life, but also in the way I pursued and took on retracing some historic expeditions in the Glen Canyon region.
Yeah, you did a lot of research there, and you know that you and I both know and love master researcher Betsy Quammen.
Mm-hmm.
You also had quite a commitment to research here, a lot of it on foot, but a lot of it with Jeep drives to meet different people, which I found amazing.
Yeah, the research, I'm such a fan of when something gets its hooks in me, I want to learn as much as I can about it. I'm so curious. And I think probably one of the neatest parts of this project was that there were different types of research, whether it was hiking on foot or looking at maps or driving, to Tuba City to go to a flea market with someone and do an interview and get to know them.
And that could have been my favorite part of the book, by the way.
I think that probably still is one of my favorite experiences, my time with Clyde Whiskers in Tuba City, a Paiute elder. But I also really enjoyed going to library archives and kind of having this, being handed a pair of gloves and this backstage pass to history to go through documents and kind of sift through the rubble of, boxes of just old stuff that there's stories, just the way they're layered into the canyons. They are in archives too. And you really have to explore to sift through them and find what's meaningful both to your work and to other people. And so that way, all those different elements of research kind of had the same philosophy behind them, even though they were all so different.
I was just taken by the fact that you spent so much time in the desert by yourself in your Jeep and in the mountains too, I guess. And you slept there and ate there. And I had such a feel for what you were doing. Me not having camped at all, really. It was like, oh my gosh, look at this lady. She's amazing.
That's a cool perspective. As someone who, to me, I don't even call it camping anymore. It's just when I live my life outside in the desert and then sometimes I'm indoors. And if anything, it's more of an asterisk, like what Morgan's inside right now, the way people would go camping. But to hear from someone who is not a camper, that it gave you a sense of what that experience is like is really cool.
Morgan, I heard on the wind this morning when I went outside that the outside is missing you.
It is missing me, and I am missing the outside as well. But the timing is good to be indoors and recovering from a cold bug. And I am in Torrey, Utah, where I've been selected as the Entrada Institute Writer in Residence. And so I have this incredible opportunity to have support for writing for 2 weeks. And, you know, specifically in the colder months of winter, I've spent a lot of time piled under blankets in the back of my car or camped out or in an old 1987 trailer I used to keep without heat, trying to write stories and books. And so, you know, and those times were wonderful, informative. But it feels really special to have the support to be at a house, at the Entrada House here in Torrey, specifically for the purpose of putting work down on the paper.
Well, first, let me say that I'm jealous because the Chuck Wagon, which you've probably been to the Chuck Wagon, the little food store, they have they have my very favorite sunflower bread loaf.
Oh,
my goodness. I love going there and getting that. And I'd always take a couple home when I'd be on my way home. But what I wanted...
They're closed now. I need to look for that when they open.
I saw something that said when I looked it up today, I wanted to make sure that I had the name right. It said temporarily closed.
Yeah, everything's closed until the start of March in this part of the world.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm glad we didn't, I'm glad we didn't come up to meet you then. Because I wouldn't have been able to get my sunflower bread.
Yeah, you would have just had to talk to me.
Hey, so let me add this much. You brought it up about camping and in the Jeep and everything. Talk about writing while you're camping in the Jeep. I assume you do it with a laptop. How do you charge it? Do you sit up when you type? Do you lay down when you type? I'm just interested how you do your work.
I mean, that has been an evolution. I do all of my writing both on the laptop and I keep notebooks. And so it's a little bit of a mixed process and, you know, the computer's when it's more formal and I'm really ready to start drafting things, but I'm always scribbling in notebooks and that's, you know, there's never an excuse. If the battery's dead or you can't use your computer, you can still write. But back in the days when I was living out of my two-door Jeep Wrangler, I had this kind of platform. It's hard to explain without a picture, but basically I'd fold the passenger seat forward and there was a platform for a bed in the back and then a wooden piece of wood would fold over. And so I could sit in the driver's seat and kind of turn sideways towards the passenger seat and use that extra piece of wood as a desk. And then I had one of those cigarette lighter chargers that you could that was two pronged for your computer. And so I could turn the car on and the heat on for a little bit and, you know, boost up a charge. And then it just kind of held me accountable that I couldn't dilly-dally. I had to write before, you know, the battery would die. And sometimes at night it would be so cold, the computer would freeze. And so I'd have to wait for it to warm up. And I'd often, you know, sleep with my laptop under my pile of down blankets to keep that from happening. Now I've sold the Jeep. I have a truck and I can lay out in the back seat and, you know, I can sort of sit up back there and I have a solar battery pack that can keep the computer going for days. And, you know, I have a nice table and lawn chair that serve as a desk. And so often it doesn't feel much different than writing in bed or at my desk at home now.
Wow. I love the thought of the scene of that. Yeah. Sitting in the Jeep. Turning to the right.
With, you know, fingerless gloves and a Goodwill thrift store fur coat to stay warm and just freezing. I mean, the other thing about that is often I would spend time reading these history books and working on the stories because when I'd wake up in the morning, the Jeep was covered in mud from driving down these wet roads. And then it would get super cold at night. And so the mud would have melted into the creases of the door and it would freeze shut so that I couldn't get out until it warmed up.
Oh, my.
And I would actually have to kick the doors open to break the ice.
You are amazing. Have you always lived this way or was this a sudden
Major,
change?
You're stupid. You know, I haven't always lived. I grew up in suburban Southern California and I didn't go backpacking until I was in my mid 20s, but I had moved to the Eastern Sierra, but I definitely was an outdoor lover. I would always go and run trails, you know, since the time I was 9 or 10 years old. I loved to sleep in the backyard when I was a kid, even through high school. There was always the part of me that just liked to be outside constantly. And then in my 20s, when I moved to the Sierra, I had never done this before, but instead of finding a place, I actually just lived out of my Buick LeSabre, a car I bought from my grandfather, and kind of just made it work in the canyons till I found a place. So the seed had been planted. It kind of came naturally to me when I kind of learned the ropes of public land and camping. I was like, oh, so I finally don't have to be inside all the time.
You're such a free spirit. What do your mother and dad think about you, or are they free spirits as well?
In their own way, they both have, you know, their very quirky, free spirited side to them, but they're not. They live in the same house I grew up in. They definitely, you know, they go on hikes around the region. They like to be outside. You know, there's definitely that sort of love for the outdoors, but in a very different way than I do. And, you know, they're just like kind of, this is the creature I've always been. So they're very supportive of it, even though they have no interest in living this way themselves.
That's wonderful.
I have much more appreciation for this book. you kind of describe what you're doing, but now that you really describe writing the book.
Well, Steve, she's also written a book about recipes that people can make when they're living out off the land, right, Morgan?
Yeah, I wrote, it's called Outlandish. It's a collection of adventure essays from my first year living on the road, just out of my Jeep, totally solo, and the different recipes and burritos and misadventures that I had that kind of taught me the value of self-reliance and creativity to make it work. I had kind of gone through a traumatic experience, not kind of, I had gone through a traumatic experience of losing almost everything that I owned in a divorce and was literally building up my life from ground zero on the ground outside. And it had many challenges and many wrong turns, but throughout the experience, I found so much beauty and really fueled myself on burritos on the path to figuring out, you know, who I was at this new venture of my life. And I really wanted to share that with other people to kind of remove some barriers between experiencing the outdoors and also going through hard times. But, hard times didn't have to mean an absence of fun and wonderful experiences, and being outdoors didn't need to be a deprivation of the wonderful food we enjoy at home, even if you are penniless.
So you want to talk a little bit about Charles Bernheimer?
Yeah.
So,
what do you want to know?
Well, I guess, where did you hear of him, and why is he such a source of inspiration? And I have to say that he was another one of these people that was ahead of his time, because he had identified where there should be a national park, okay? And it took a lot of ups and downs, ups and then some more downs and then ups again to bring that to fruition. And I hope somehow he knows that.
I think he knows. Or he would know. Yeah, so I heard of Charles Bernheimer through the many history books I was reading about Southern Utah, Glen Canyon, the Bears Ears area. He was a wealthy businessman from Manhattan who was born and raised in Germany, and then came here in his teens. And he was always inspired by adventurous stories about the West since he was a child. And finally, in his 50s and 60s, he used his well-off financial means to pursue the adventures he used to read about. And so he hired local and native guides from Southern Utah to take him on these month-long pack train tours of Southern Utah and the Navajo Nation for a decade, from 1919 to 1930. And what started out as kind of just sightseeing trips to getting the lay of the land, Bernheimer wanted something more. He wanted to give back and contribute something with his ability to be out here. And so he became a donor to the American Museum of Natural History, who then loaned him an archaeologist, Earl Morris, and he was able to also recruit John Wetherill, one of the most famous Canyon Country guides, along with Zeke Johnson, who was a local Utah guide, and take these trips and do massive surveys for the American Museum under permit in a time when the Antiquities Act was pretty brand new. And so permitted research trips for archaeology with Native guides, Navajo guides involved, was such a new thing. And at the culmination of this 10-year journey he was on, it came to his attention that there was a proposal for potential dams on the Colorado River that would impact his beloved Rainbow Bridge, which is, you know, he took multiple trips to Rainbow Bridge. He was just enamored by it. It was pretty much the centerpiece of why he came out here. And so Bernheimer said, well, now I'm going to use what this knowledge that I've amassed and the support of the guides I've worked with to propose a national park in Glen Canyon, really the Monument Valley, Navajo Nation, Glen Canyon, and try and protect Rainbow Bridge. Those efforts evolved into a proposal for Bears Ears and Escalante to be national monuments as well. Long story, fast forwarded, short, you can read about in the book. These things were shut down for various reasons, and then World War II happened, and it just fizzled out, and Bernheimer passed away. But knowing that history and this moment in time where I was reading it, when Bears Ears National Monument was designated, then undesignated, and Grand Staircase Escalante's protections were being trifled with, and I thought, wow, this shows really that this isn't like a new issue. This has been a century in the making. There's been a lot of thought put into why these areas should be protected. And if we don't reckon with this now, what's going to happen for the next century? And so that's how the project was born. And my deep fascination with the quirky man, Charles Bernheimer, who liked to bring suits and ties and cigars on his horse packing trips, but still liked to brag about who lived like a cowboy and eating beans on the ground. And his stories were just so humorous and down to earth. So it brought this really heady conservation topic that's so controversial right now, but it brought it into the, you know, the real, like a tangible thing I understood, which is loving getting out on these explorations in Utah.
Yeah. And I, like you said, read the book. After I asked that question, I was like, geez, people won't buy the book.
I didn't mean that in a sarcastic way. It's just like, it's a lot of history, even for people who are into history.
Oh, yeah.
Part of what I love about your book is I'm not a big history fan, but you weave it into the story so well that it pulls me in. I get so interested. Yeah,
you weave it into the story and you talk about Bernheimer, and then you're where Bernheimer was. You're retracing his steps. That was great.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I remember having a conversation with my mom about one aspect of history in the book, and she's like, you better chop that one up. She's like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to hang on for that one.
So real quick, Linda, break in any time, but you know, I got all my millions of questions here. Deb Holland. Okay, I haven't had the opportunity to meet Deb Holland. I've kind of followed where she's been a couple of days later, but she's made a big impact on the Department of Interior, obviously with the Bears Ears restoration of Equime, which I helped with that. And this last national monument, I don't remember the name of it, but any thoughts on Deb Holland? Have you been able to meet her?
I have not been able to meet her. And as I wrote in the book, I mean, it's such a huge step forward toward Indigenous people having not just a stake, but leading the way of how we manage our land, the land in this country, the land that is their homeland. But obviously, but I'm wary to weigh in more on just, I mean, she's wonderful, but you know, I'm curious how we carry this forward, where we go from here, because there's a lot more work to be done.
I like your thoughts on grazing on public lands, because you tackle grazing on public lands for the Indigenous people. I think you supported some grazing in Bears Ears for the Indigenous.
Yeah. Throughout Bears Ears, the Navajo Nation, Glen Canyon, I chose to focus on the historic environmental impacts and how much the land has been changed by grazing and invasive species that have been brought in by cattle. And because I think that's even for most environmentalists, the scope of what did this land look like prior to cattle is really hard to fathom. And it's difficult to find photos. I was able to track some down. And so that historical context is often missing from the conversation about grazing and also about water and water table and our river and creek and stream bred corridors. And so I really wanted to just focus, like with most aspects of the book, on the changes. So we understand cattle impacts are human impacts. And we are all part of the human impacts. And so we all, there's kind of a reckoning we all have to understand, whether we like grazing or not, that we're also probably using electricity that comes from a dam that destroyed a river that some people love and other people, you know, many people considered home and sacred. And so really focusing on the history more than picking sides, I should say, which isn't to say that I don't have strong opinions about things. And also putting into context how grazing was, you know, a source of livelihood for the Navajo people, especially in the 20th century, and how it was their lifeblood. And for many people in rural communities, this is still part of their heritage as well. And so it's such a complex and layered issue that really deserves more focus on the history and the good and the bad and just the reality. And it was really fascinating to learn about that through talking to all kinds of different people with different perspectives, but also getting out on the land with the old photos and journals and really thinking about the changes.
Morgan, in your book, The Path of Light, you talk about your Instagram account at running_bum_, and you also talk about the behind-the-scenes work that you do, which I found, it made me exhausted to think of everything you do. You said you're photographer, lighting director, producer, model, and then you talked a little bit about social media. Would you like to share with our listeners a little bit of everything you do in addition to writing?
I get tired thinking about it. I mean, the worst part of doing any sort of work on social media, honestly, is that the amount of time you have to interface with your phone screen. It's terrible for everybody. But the upside of that work is that I've learned to treat my phone and social media like my office. And I do the work, and then I don't spend a lot of time scrolling or digesting things on my phone that aren't meaningful to me. So I think that balance, you know, social media is part of our world, and I'm grateful that I've been able to find sort of a balance of use that works for me. But yeah, you know, it's kind of one of those things where something chooses you. I never really intended my Instagram account to gain such a following. 7 years ago when I moved into my Jeep, the interest really picked up, and it boomed into opportunities to become an influencer for certain brands that aligned. You know, I'm very selective of who I work with, and I, you know, only promote products and brands that I have true relationships with and things that I use. And I definitely have a complicated relationship with it because I'm not someone who likes to advocate consuming more and more stuff. I actually really try and pare down what I have, even what I'm willing to have sent to me as an exchange for the work I do. But people do need stuff, and I need to work. And so this really fuses my background is I've worked as a VP of a marketing firm in a past life in my 20s, and have also done fitness modeling. And obviously I love to write and be creative and take photos. And so this became such a great opportunity to have work that supported my lifestyle and allowed me, honestly, to invest such deep time in extensive research. Historian isn't a lucrative path to just freelance historian is not a lucrative path. And so to have something that allowed me to feed myself and put gas in my tank from anywhere is something I'm always going to be grateful for. In the time since, I've actually spun off and I've been doing less promotional work, and I am managing social media for a nonprofit Friends Conservation Group here in Southern Utah. To put my words to use in Path of Light, where I talk about how important it is for the people doing the heavy lifting to protect these areas to use social media for their benefit and to help educate the public on respectful use of the land and how they can get involved to help steward and protect it as well.
That's fantastic. And one thing we could talk about for just a minute is when you become a public figure, you have trolls, correct? You mentioned that in the book, that they can be quite cruel at times.
Yeah, I've been dealt some blows in the last few years, just in finance and relationships, and, you know, everyone has their ups and downs, but that has been probably one of the hardest things to deal with. Because people feel that they have this veil behind the computer screen to say whatever they want and forget that there's a human on the other side. And from my experience, this went far beyond people having a difference of an opinion or not just liking me, but to the level of like online stalking and true harassment and sexual harassment and targeting my employers and trying to, you know, get me to lose jobs and have publishers not work with me. I'm really grateful that everyone that I've worked with has been able to get me through this and in many ways help me piece together the people who were attacking me in this way and help me find some closure and move on from it. But it really showed me a dark side of what people feel they can do through the internet. And it, you know, I know this is not an isolated issue. There are lots of other people going through it, and it's extremely harmful. And some of the research I dug into when working on Path of Light is that this has become a global like safety issue, particularly for women. And so I think there needs to be, I've often, when I've been trolled or attacked online, I've kept quiet because I don't want to feed the fire. And that's not the energy I choose to bring to my life. And, you know, I've had many bad days, and it's certainly been something I've talked and vented about and gone to therapy for and been scared about. But I didn't want to publicly talk about it and feel the fire until I felt like I had the space to talk about it safely and where I could turn the sound off on other people and just share my story. And that's what Path of Light surprisingly opened up a door for me to do. It wasn't, I didn't think I would have that avenue until I realized that, you know, some of Bernheimer's guides had been harassed in the media as well. And so it felt like a timely historic thing to talk about.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It's a real danger, especially for our young women.
Mm-hmm.
So it is. It's good to talk about it, get that out in the open, and especially that it happens to somebody as talented, brilliant, and beautiful as you are. So there it is.
There it is. So getting back to art, or maybe not to art. So over the past couple of years, I had a friend, and we spent a lot of time looking up at the sky and trying to determine what the color of a cloudless Utah sky is. Okay, and the answers are many, but I know in your book you came up with one color, and I like it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Did I say? Azure, yeah. Azure. I'm like, wait, I'm like, what page of the book? I wasn't ready for this quiz.
You know, I highlighted it because I have a book I highlight all over the daggone place. That was one of my highlights.
I do that too. I love it.
So I like looking up at the cloudless blue sky, and it's probably in Nevada, but we're close, right? So
it's the same part of the world in regional aspects.
It's just such an amazing color of azure blue.
It is beautiful.
It is. So,
and my only other question here is because of my partner here, Linda, I know why she moved here, or I know why you guys stayed here. Okay, and if you go to, you have a quote in here, an unexpected ray of light, and you said, others choose home not by familiar ties, but by color and light. And Linda's told me the story of when her and Ron moved here, he moved here for the golf courses, and she ended up liking the colors. But it took you a while, didn't it, to figure out what the colors were.
Oh, the color and the light.
So that was your Ellen Molloy quote.
Ugh, I love that quote so much. When I read that, I was loving where I was in the world, but also feeling kind of displaced. And that quote's from The Anthropology of Turquoise. And that book really helped me make sense of my journey of choosing home.
Morgan, you want to tell us about what you're working on now as you're doing your residency? Is it a new novel?
I'm working on a couple things. The first and the pressing deadline you alluded to is I have a story coming up for Arizona Highways. I've been contributing to them for a couple years now, and I love the stories I get to write for that wonderful magazine. Such history behind it. It's a profile of Andrew Ellicott Douglas, who is one of the pioneering founders of dendrochronology, the science of tree rings. And I'm doing a deep dive into how that science helped us understand climate records in the Southwest and past Colorado River flows, the inconvenient science that was ignored to create the West we now live in. So it's a heady topic that goes from astronomy to tree rings to water flows and infrastructure, but I like where it's going. So that's what I'm on right now. But that flows into the bigger project I'm working on, which is a book, a work of nonfiction that is about the Colorado River and the unseen communities that we're connected to through water.
Wow, they both sound fascinating, don't they, Steve?
They do. They do. And we wouldn't have to worry about tree rings if they had just listened to John Wesley Powell.
Right. I mean, it's certainly not the only person who's provided strong evidence that things weren't going to go so well. Not to mention, you know, consulting with indigenous people who have lived here for millennia and who understand the climate shifts of this region. But it's interesting, I won't give it all away, but part of the twist is that...
Oh, yeah, you don't have to give anything away.
Oh, no, it's not even like the hook and sinker. It's just I did some archival research, and Douglas was contracted by the LA Department of Water and Power to measure the flow, historic flows of the Colorado River, so they could figure out what was really feasible with Hoover Dam. I mean, so this, you know, this wasn't someone, like, they asked him for help and then did what they did.
Have you always loved to write, Morgan?
Oh, yeah. Ever since I was a kid. When I was in elementary school, I would write stories and I would make pretend magazines and write the articles and draw the pictures and staple them together. And I would even make the subscription cards in the middle of the magazine.
I love
and
that.
I got to play on the typewriter, and, you know, I wanted to be a writer and to travel the world, and to be able to do so is still one of the things I wake up every day, no matter, you know, certainly has its ups and downs and hard things about it, but I'm so grateful to do it because it's been in me the whole time.
Are you also a marathon runner?
Past life. I've run several, and that was never my great love of running. I was a middle distance track runner all the way. You know, I stopped racing basically when I was 30 and switched to mountain and trails briefly, and then got so tugged to just explore and finally be free of the watch and let my creativity kind of take over my physical pursuits too. And, you know, I love what being a seriously trained athlete taught me. And I know it's helped me with my writing, the discipline to sit now instead of run. And I get to take running breaks instead of write in between training sessions. But I'd be happy to never run a marathon again.
Understand.
Yeah, I like
now what, I like to dance out the door without my watch and look at things and stop when I please and keep going if I feel called to. It's much more liberating now.
And you're not afraid of being alone, are you? You're alone a lot of times in the wilderness.
Yeah, no, I'm not afraid of being alone. I've learned how to enjoy it. I mean, when I was younger, I sometimes thought I didn't like being alone, but I like to think of it now as I just had not learned how to be alone in a fulfilling way. And I think that's something that has served me really well by spending time in the desert and to realize that I'm not alone. What am I here with? And that comes back to the project I'm working on. What am I in community with when I feel like I'm alone out in nature? But I, you know, I do have my wits about me. When I'm alone, I am definitely more cautious than I'm with other people. You know, a simple fall could be a really serious thing. And I've definitely been in really remote areas on very serious terrain alone. And of course I was afraid, but sure. It's not that fear simply of being alone. It's awareness of the stakes are high.
Understand. Do you carry a Garmin or anything like that?
I do. Okay. I do. I didn't for a long time. I just would forge out with a paper map and, you know, I'd text my mom and I'd call her when I'd get back into cell service. I remember one time driving down to Hite Marina in Glen Canyon. I didn't have cell service. And when the marina was still there a few years ago, and using the landline to call her and let her know that I was fine, I wouldn't have cell service for a few days. And when I got off the phone, an adorable older man walks in, his little button-up plaid shirt. He asks the woman for the phone and does the same thing to call his wife.
I called my wife from the Hite Marina once, so.
Yeah! I'm sure they used to get a lot of calls like that.
You just mentioned creativity and that a watch stifles your creativity. You want to talk creativity a second?
Yeah.
I mean, creativity, I think, is the most important thing about our podcast, getting people's definitions of creativity, because everybody's the same, but everybody's different.
Right. You know, so I guess rather than trying to just define it, I think I'd like to just come back to something I've learned through this experience of having so much freedom to pursue a creative life. I am very privileged to have a ton of freedom in my life and to be self-employed and really steer my ship and choose my course. But I've also come to realize that limitless freedom is not always the best for creativity. You have to find something that reins you in and You know, I'm not a fence or a house or a 9-to-5 working kind of person. For me, that sort of structure became the landscape itself. So whether it's moving my body through a river corridor or along a ridgeline, or trying to understand the history of a certain geography that's really captivated me through that movement, that's kind of served as the spark for where I direct my research, my writing. The colors speak to me. I'm very sensitive to place with my writing. Certain settings definitely work or don't work for me and affect how I write. And so I think rethinking, you know, freedom is also the freedom to choose. I don't want to say limits, but the canvas for our creativity.
Morgan, we have our final question we ask all our guests. What has inspired you this week?
Well, I've been pretty sick and had to delay some things that I wanted to do, and I'm just feeling pretty inspired. My partner Aaron has been so supportive and sent me off to the writing retreat with homemade sauce, and I'm actually pretty inspired. I rent a little place in a small rural town now, and I'm really feeling inspired that though I spend so much of my life living and preferring to be outside, that I can feel at home indoors with Aaron.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today, Morgan. We were so excited about this interview. We know you're a busy lady, but we appreciate the time you're spending with us today and our listeners.
Yeah, and I guess one last thing is sell your books.
Yeah, let's do that too.
Tory House Press, but do you want to go a little deeper on that? Website?
So you can purchase Path of Light through the Tory House Press website, toryhouse.org. They're a nonprofit. They publish Voices for the Land and do great work to advance literacy in the Intermountain West. You're probably familiar with some of the other writers that share the Tory House wonderful bookshelf, Craig Childs, Jonathan P. Thompson, David Gessner, Amy Irvine, Catherine Wilder. I could just Ralph Barillo, Jonathan Bailey. I'm tongue-tied because, you know, Pam Houston. If you're not tuned into Tory House Books, I definitely recommend signing up for their newsletter, because there is some incredible work coming out this year, including a book by Zach Podmore about Glen Canyon, for all of you who are listening for that reason, Glen Canyon lovers. But yeah, so you can get Path of Light through toryhouse.org and also through your local independent bookstores throughout the Southwest.
Okay, and I'll say one other thing about Tory House Press. There's no book that feels better in my hands, and I'm holding this now, than a Tory House Press book. They're
beautiful, aren't they?
They feel good. I don't know what the cover is or what, but they feel good. So, Morgan, thank you so much.
Thank you for taking the time to read Path of Light and for having me on your show. It's great talking to you both.
Yeah, say hi to all our friends at Entrada.
Thanks,
I
Morgan.
I will.
Thank you, Morgan.
All right, you too.
Stay warm.
Bye-bye. Good,
bye.
Broadcasting from the Mesquite Works Steam Center in the scenic Mojave Desert, the Art Box sponsors thank you for listening. You can find us on Spotify and Amazon Music. Please subscribe so you don't miss an episode. We welcome all comments. You can email us at artboxvv@gmail.com. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of its hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the Virgin Valley Artists Association.